you know, to believe in Trump reality TV style presidency, you have to have the willing suspension of disbelief. But I think there's a sort of willing suspension of everything with the Democratic campaign. You know, I have conversations with people about Kamala Harris, and they say, you know, she's just the greatest thing. I was talking to a Democratic woman last night who was saying she is just so hot. I mean, she's just smoking hot. And it just felt like, I don't think you mean this. It's almost like they've all taken some magic potion and they're all just babbling. They're talking in weird tongues.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Freddie Gray. Freddie, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Brendan.
It's great to have you on. And of course, I want to talk to you about America in your capacity as the Spectator's Mr. America and the host of its Americano podcast. You're there right now doing coverage, reporting, and trying to work out what's going on with this presidential election. So there's a lot to chew over, I think, in relation to this strange world event that is occurring. But I guess the first thing I want to ask you is, what is the atmosphere like there? I mean, it can be hard to get a grasp on it from outside of the US. You know, we see the headlines, we see the strange events, we see the memes and everything else. But what's it like to be in the thick of it with, I guess, people talking about the election and talking about who they're going to vote for? What is the vibe in the US right now?
Well, I'm in Chicago, where the Democratic National Convention is taking place. And I know it's an easy thing for a journalist to say, to complain about, that I'm finding it all so strange, it's hard to get a handle on what to say. But it is, it's very strange. The Democrats are talking a lot about joy. And, you know, if you go into the convention hall, there are a lot of people, and it does seem to be buzzing, but it does seem quite a synthetic joy because it's such a strange situation. Last night we had Joe Biden, who came on very, very late. His speech started very, very late, 10:30 Chicago time, which is much later West Coast time and past prime time for most Americans, which is obviously the whole point of the big headline speech, is that it's bang in prime time, so it gets seen by most people. There were sort of conspiracy theories going around that maybe they were worried he'd have another meltdown, and that if they just, you know, pushed him later, then that wouldn't happen. But I don't really buy that, because in the digital age, you know, every meltdown is going to go viral. I think it was just they just overran and made a mistake, and he ended up kind of just going on too late. But the very fact that they let that happen shows how brutally the kind of Democratic leadership, the people who organize the Democratic Party, have treated Joe Biden. They have, you know, since that debate where he had such a disastrous time, they have completely humiliated him while pretending to praise him as the greatest president, you know, since Lincoln. So it's just a very, very strange situation. And it's very hard to talk to Democrats about it because you feel like you're talking to people from an alternate reality. And I think this is, you know, what's going on in American politics, and perhaps in British politics too, is it's ossifying, divisions are ossifying, and we are now in completely different worlds.
That's a really interesting kickoff to the discussion, because I think some listeners will think, well, American politics has always been a little bit synthetic. I mean, certainly in the modern era, you know, it's always had a bit more of a celebrity touch to it than boring old British politics. You know, we had the politics of personality that really took off in the United States and then, of course, spread to the UK with Tony Blair and others. But there's always been that sense that American politics is a strange beast. Do you think it's become more like that? Do you think in this election that you're observing right at the heart of the DNC, do you think it's become even more synthetic, even more fake, even more hollow, I guess, and bereft of politics and meaning, and now just all the show and nothing else?
I think it has. I think this is the most synthetic one, as I've used that word already. But I think, you know, it's always show business in American politics. It's always razzle dazzle. These are never sort of hard policy discussions. It is all about the personalities and the kind of the glamour and the power of it. But, you know, to believe in, even in Trump reality TV style presidency, to believe in that, you have to have the, you know, the willing suspension of disbelief. I think there's a sort of willing suspension of everything with this campaign, with the Democratic campaign. You know, I have conversations with people about Kamala Harris, and they say, you know, she's just the greatest thing. I was talking to a Democratic woman last night who was saying she is just so hot. She's just smoking hot. She's the most beautiful woman. And it just felt like, I don't think you mean this. It's almost like they've all taken some magic potion And they're all just babbling. They're talking in weird tongues.
I want to ask you about Kamala Harris in particular, because I find her phenomenal, and not in a good way. I find her inscrutable and strange, and her meteoric rise, I think, is very curious and probably very indicative of where politics in general is at. But the one thing people say about her is that she has good vibes. And I'm not just talking about people on Twitter or wherever else they might be, but genuine commentators, like serious old people who write articles in the mainstream media, will say that she's got the right vibes, she's got a good feeling about her, she makes people feel good. And it's almost like there's been a complete shoving aside of any question of policy or any question about why she hasn't sat down to do a proper media interview yet. None of those things seem to matter. All that seems to matter is that she gives off a good vibe. Is that the sense you get from speaking to people there? Is that how shallow it's become?
I think it is how shallow it's become. I do think there's been a couple of pieces, Axios and New York Times, a couple of pieces sort of suggesting, you know, enough is enough. We do need to get a better sense of what she's going to do as president now. You know, she's obviously had this honeymoon period, but the media that would normally be supportive of her are now beginning to say, you know, it's time for her to kind of, you know, reveal more. But then I spoke to a Democratic fundraiser this morning, and he thinks that the speech on Thursday, apologies if this is coming out after Thursday, but he thinks that that speech will not be policy driven. It will be biographical, which again is just storytelling. And, you know, we'll hear about Kamala Harris working at McDonald's, becoming a prosecutor, you know, and she was the child of two perfectly affluent left-wing academics. Her career as a prosecutor is one that is quite hard to bill as hugely successful, apart from for her. She failed upwards consistently throughout her career. There was a good video somebody's done of going around asking various Democrats, you know, what is it that you most love that Kamala Harris has done in the last 4 years as vice president? And nobody could answer the question. And then some of them would say at the end of the interview, actually, don't use that, because they realised that they don't actually have anything to cling on to. And so it's fairy tale stuff, but it doesn't even have the meat of a fairy tale. It's emptier than that.
I think it was the Washington Post that pointed out that her website doesn't have an issues page, but it does have a biography page, which I thought was very telling. And then I looked at her website, and it's absolutely true. There's nothing about policy or issues, but there is a long biography page about her parents taking her to civil rights marches in her pushchair, all that kind of stuff that I'm sure gets certain people going.
Well, you know the story about the pushchair and freedom. So she used to tell this story that when she was on that civil rights march with her parents in a pram or whatever, her mother at some point said, "What do you want?" Talking about food or something. And Kamala Harris said, "Freedom." And this story was then revealed to have been copied from Martin Luther King, who told it in a different context. And so she just dropped the story. It had to be sort of shaved out of the biography.
It is remarkable. I guess when you're stitching together a story that is purely biographical, then there is going to be that temptation to borrow from more interesting biographies, because she's got nothing else to promote herself with, I guess. I think in relation to the Kamala Harris thing, I did want to ask you, there has been such a palpable shift in the way in which even Democrats talk about her, because I think for some time she was recognized to be a pretty unpopular politician. People either didn't know what she was about, or they were just put off by her because she seemed like a West Coast intellectual or just a West Coast snob. And also that never-ending laugh of hers, I'm sure that turns off people as well. And now you have Democrats talking about her as if she's the best thing since sliced bread. She's going to save the Republic from another Trump term. Is that shift in the perception of Kamala Harris, is that reflected in public opinion? Or is there still skepticism and confusion about who this woman is and what she represents?
I think there's a degree of doubt about whether she can pull it off, whether she can pull off this amazing kind of turnaround act. But there's so much willingness for her to do it. And I think what binds it together is the hatred of Donald Trump and this determination to stop Donald Trump at all costs, even if that means completely pretending to fall in love with Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the sense one gets watching this from afar, that the glue holding this Kamala show together is really anti-Trumpism, or just that profound fear of Trump getting back into power, which lots of people have. In relation to Kamala Harris and also her pick for VP, Tim Walz, I understand both of them primarily through memes. So the only thing I know really about Kamala Harris is that she didn't fall out of a coconut tree. You know, she is unburdened by what has been and so on. One of the few things I know about Tim Walz is that he eats white guy tacos. You know, this is a big thing that's been going around the internet, which means he doesn't have much spice on his tacos. I mean, it's really at that level that we are invited to relate to these politicians. Now, in the past, I might have put that down to my own lack of research and my own lack of reading, but that really is the front and center message about these two, what vibes they give off, their ability to be memed, or, you know, their ability to be turned into merch that some 32-year-old hipster might want to wear. I mean, is that the level at which it's taking place in the US as well? Is there anything more in terms of what people are talking about in relation to both of them?
Well, I think, I mean, if you try and get away from the vibes and stuff, which is obviously just flam, and you try and sort of look at what the agenda is, there is a sort of leaning left on the economy, talking about housing, building housing. I went to an event yesterday where two Labour MPs were invited over to talk about how the centre-left can connect with working people, working class people, and, you know, what sort of lessons Labour can teach the Democrats about how successful they've been at doing that, which is quite amusing in itself. But the couple of things they dwelled on were, you know, the climate, which they claim is a big concern for working people, that's debatable, and housing and, you know, cost of living. And I think in as much as Harris is going to talk about anything, she is going to talk about that. She's talked about stopping shops from price gouging, which is very, very un-American. That's, you know, it's real socialist talk, price controls effectively. And on housing, again, like the Labour Party, you can say you're going to build a lot of houses, but until you've actually done it, it's not a thing. So even on those things, it's thin. And the other thing I should have mentioned is Gaza. There was a pro-Palestine march yesterday. It was supposed to be enormous, but actually it wasn't. It was just a few thousand people. And it was very much like a London pro-Palestine march. There was sort of lots of trans flags everywhere and a sort of weird collage of, you know, black liberation, anti-Fa elements, the strange blend of the new left. But they are applying quite a lot of pressure on the Democrats to be harsher on Israel and to use the word genocide. Joe Biden didn't go there yesterday, although he said, you know, the people on the streets, they have a point. But then he said that, you know, both sides are wrong. So they're being pushed to suggest that they will condemn Israel. I don't think they will make that mistake, because in American politics, a lot of very, very wealthy donors are very pro-Israel. They are not going to want to condemn Israel in the terms that these Democrat rebels want them to. But I think they're also betting that actually when push comes to shove, a lot of these rebels are going to come in line anyway, because it's them or Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is far more aligned with Israel.
That's a really good point. So much of the new left, as you call it, you know, they go off and play for 4 years at being radicals and waving all their flags, but they always come home for dinner, as one might say, when it comes to election time. They always come back, vote for Labour, vote for the Democrats, do as they're told. So if the upper echelons of the Democrats are thinking, well, they'll vote for us anyway, they're probably not entirely wrong. I think lots of them will. But I did want to ask you on the Palestine question. I mean, it is so striking that these demonstrations have become yet another outlet for all the woke nonsense, you know, the trans stuff, the whole queers for Palestine ideology. I did want to ask you how that's impacting on the Harris camp. So you suggest that they are not going to do what these protesters want them to do. But regardless of that, is it having a detrimental impact? You know, we have seen Kamala Harris has been referred to as Holocaust Harris online, which is gross and a bad case of Holocaust relativism, comparing the war in Gaza to the Holocaust. You know, it's the usual crap that these people come out with. Do you think it's become a fault line? Because I guess Kamala Harris really does crave the support of the graduate elites and, you know, the right-thinking members of the Western East Coastal elites. Is she worried that some of them are turning off her because of this one issue in particular?
Yes, I'm sure she is. I mean, Democratic leaders have to talk in language that, in a British context, you'd say, you know, in language that would be acceptable at an Islington dinner party. They have to use those lines. And obviously the line on Gaza now is to say Israel is wrong, it's appalling, and, you know, possibly use the word genocide. And I think Harris is feeling that pressure. I think the state that they're most worried about is Michigan, which has a very large Arab community who are very exercised about this issue. And so they want to placate them. And Michigan is a key swing state. At the moment, it looks, according to polls, it looks like Harris might be in a position to win Michigan. But you know, if, let's say, Israel and Iran get into a major escalation, an even more major escalation, and before the election, and Harris is pushed into a point where she has to condemn Iran or show a big show of solidarity with Israel, that could cost her votes in Michigan, which could lose her the election. So it is a worry for the Democrats. And that's why you see, even though these protests were not that big, I was there, they're something that Republicans are seizing on, and that you're seeing a lot of Republican footage of the protests, you know, making it out to be far more radical and large than they are. I spoke briefly to Cornel West, who is running as an independent, and he's an African-American politician, very kind of on the hard left of American politics. And I said to him, you know, what do you say to people who think you're helping Donald Trump win, which is Kamala Harris's line. She says, you know, if you want Donald Trump to win, keep shouting about Gaza. And he said, don't put it on me. If the Democrats are willing to condemn the genocide, then they'll find a lot of more people support them.
Yeah, I mean, it will be grimly fascinating to see how this plays out. I mean, the fact that an awful war has become largely a kind of point of cleavage in Western internal politics is revealing in its own way. You mentioned earlier the treatment of Biden, and I did want to ask you about what's going on with Biden. I mean, I have found myself flitting violently between anger at Biden for all the silly stuff that he's done over the past few years, and also sympathy with him for the way in which the ruthless upper echelons of the Democrats have treated him. So for a long time, they told us he was absolutely fine. He had no mental problems whatsoever, no memory problems. He's good. And anyone who says otherwise is a liar and ageist and stupid, etc. Then they suddenly said, after that awful CNN debate where he performed very, very badly, they said, he's got to go. He's a liability. We won't win with him. Let's get rid of him. And there was essentially virtually a coup to push him out. And now they're back to saying he's one of the greatest presidents ever. We love him. We're going to wheel him onto stage at 10:30 at night to show him to the public. I mean, it is really awful, isn't it? The way in which they've treated him. What do you think that tells us about the Democrats?
I think it tells us they will do anything to keep Donald Trump out of the White House. And one of the reasons they stuck by Biden so long was he was seen as the Trump slayer. He had beaten Trump in 2020, and they thought he had the sort of formula and enough blue collar appeal to do it again. But when it became perfectly obvious that he wasn't going to do it, they were willing to jettison him. You know, I think that debate now is extraordinary because it was seen such a disaster at the time for the Democrats broadly. And yet now it's a kind of bizarre blessing in disguise. And, you know, conspiracy theorists think that maybe it was a plot that they brought the debate forward to give themselves enough time, because the debates were supposed to be later in the year and the Democrats asked to have them earlier. Again, I think that's not really a true thing. I think they were more thinking, we're behind, we're failing in the polls, let's get a debate and try and change up the momentum of the race. After the debate, everything changed and Kamala Harris has come in. And I think a lot of the momentum is just this sheer relief that they weren't going to have to keep going with the Biden act, and that the Harris act, even though it's still an act, is much more, in a superficial way, it's much more believable because she's not in massive decline. But it is very, very horrible for Joe Biden. And almost there was sort of this weird applause, there was intense applause, there was a 4.5-minute standing ovation for him yesterday. And it was guilt-driven, I felt. You saw Nancy Pelosi in the crowd going, I love Joe. We love Joe. We love Joe. And, you know, she is the woman who effectively pushed him out. And she had this extraordinary quote yesterday when she was interviewed on a network. She was asked, you know, why did she turn on Biden in the way she did? And she said, sometimes you've got to take a punch to protect the children, which is such an odd thing to say. There's a kind of guilty affection. And if we just keep clapping and crying about how much we love Joe and telling him how much we love him, we will make up for the fact we've effectively put him out to pasture, having pretended that he was okay for 4 years or more.
Guilty affection is a really good way to describe it. You know, a guilty affection to try and cover up the shameful way they've behaved towards Biden over the past few years, especially over the past few months. What is your sense of what this all means behind the scenes in the Democrats, which can be quite a difficult terrain to read? But, you know, Biden must be fuming. Jill Biden, I'm sure, is running around like Lady Macbeth. I'm sure she's at the end of her tether with all of this, with the coup and everything else that took place. It's not clear that the Obamas, even though they did that horribly staged phone call with Kamala Harris saying, "You go, girl," and all that stuff, it's not at all clear that they're happy with her, although they do seem to be happy that Biden's been pushed aside. I mean, it really is Shakespearean levels of backstabbing and skullduggery. Is that the sense you get from speaking to Democrats, or are they keeping all that stuff under the covers?
Well, and Shakespearean levels of acting. You know, Biden has always been something of an actor. And, you know, last night was his sort of last performance where he was just going to get through it and he was going to be loyal. He said he would be a volunteer, you know, great volunteer for this campaign. And, you know, it was his last sort of, well, it wasn't his last, there'll be more, but it was an attempt by him to say, yeah, don't worry, I'm going to keep this act up until we get through the election. But there's been quite good reporting on how angry he was, and it seems he was very angry. Jill Biden certainly was furious. Jill Biden apparently has no like for Kamala Harris whatsoever, but they'll just go along with it. They'll keep faking it until they make it.
It is an extraordinary state of affairs. I can't wait for the future books and future Netflix series so we can find out what's going on.
But the Democrats' message discipline is so tight, you wonder sometimes if you'll ever find out. They stick so loyally to the script, even when the script doesn't make any sense at all.
Absolutely. It's kind of chilling. Okay, Freddie, I want to ask you about Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and that side of the equation. Let's start with Trump. I sometimes think to myself, you know, it was only 5 weeks ago that he was shot and would have died if his head was, you know, one more inch to the left or whatever. And I, like lots of other people, thought to myself, well, that's it. That's the presidency in the bag for him. These are iconic images of him standing up and punching the air and saying, fight, fight, fight. I thought that showed extraordinary courage, actually. I'm not sure I would have done that if I'd just been shot in the head. And I thought, well, there you go. Trump's going to win. There's no challenge to it whatsoever. But now I have to remind myself that he was shot. It does seem to have been not memory hold as such, but it isn't quite as front and center as one might have expected. What do you think is going on in the post-assassination attempt moment?
Well, I agree with you that memory hold is a sort of, you know, slightly Republican right-wing talking point. And you can't quite control reality that much, no matter who you are. But there is this odd, just, I think, because it was such a shocking moment. And you suddenly had Silicon Valley billionaires who had always been very opposed to Trump coming out very forcefully in his favor, like Elon Musk. You know, Mark Zuckerberg saying it was badass. You know, Mark Zuckerberg's been a huge opponent of Trump. And I think that as the weeks kind of have gone on and that, I guess, the Democratic psychodrama has meant that it's just washed it all away to a large extent. You know, I thought that picture, as everybody did, the picture of him with his fist in the air just after having shouted, fight, 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 was going to be this sort of iconic image. But the script of this election is far stranger than that. Sorry, I keep talking about scripts and acting, but that's because it is all show busy. I think they are struggling, the Republicans. I think, you know, Michelle Obama, you say, when they go low, you go high. The Democrats have decided, you know, they can be low and lower. They can make jokes about how J.D. Vance likes to have sex with sofas or couches. They can just call Trump and Vance weird over and over again and sort of titter. And it's true that Trump, who has risen to the top through insults, doesn't seem to be handling it very well. And I think Waltz is well-liked among Democrats, partly because he seems to be quite good at this, just sort of chuckling at Trump and his absurdities and admitting that he finds Trump funny, you know, rather than casting him as the Antichrist, although they do that at the same time, but they act as though they're unfazed by him. And I think that is proving to be effective, and you're possibly seeing that in the polls. And Trump has been scrambling a bit. I mean, he attacked Georgia Governor Brian Kemp who's a popular governor in Georgia, Republican, for no good reason. It was a very odd thing to do. And Georgia is a key swing state. So I think he's sort of lashing around, trying to find some attack line on Harris, you know, whether it's attacking her background or just sticking to what a disaster she was on the southern border, which she was. But they haven't seemed to have found their response yet. I think they will, because Harris will have to put herself forward more and more as the election approaches, and she will expose her vulnerabilities.
Yeah, I think that's right. The, you know, if leading Democrats behave as if they're not fazed particularly by Trump, that could be far more wounding to Trump than if they're hopping mad about him and calling him the next Hitler and all the stuff they did in 2016, which was pretty beneficial to Trump because he could depict them all as a bunch of hysterics, which many of them were.
My theory on that is that I've always had this pet theory that if only Trump's opponents had treated him with kindness, there would be no Trump phenomenon. If only people had said, oh, he's a very good businessman. You know, Democrats said, a good businessman. I don't agree with a lot of his ideas, but I appreciate his passion and all that sort of stuff. You know, there would be none of the force of the Trump movement, which is really just a reaction to Trump hatred. And those two things feed each other. Obviously, the Democrats aren't doing that now. They're not being so kind. But they're not doing kind of crazed Trump hatred. They seem to have learned that that doesn't work.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And on Trump himself, my impression watching from afar is that, I don't know how to put it, it seems like he's not landing in the way that he did in the past, or it seems that he's lost his magic touch or whatever touch he used to have. He's not dominating the discussion in the way that one might have expected. I remember when he was confirmed as the Republican candidate, I remember my WhatsApp groups were buzzing and people were saying, this is going to be so funny and hilarious. You know, he's back in the ring. And it seems to have fizzled out. And I've been trying to figure out, is that true? Is it true that it's fizzled out? Or is it a different situation in the US itself? And if it is true, what might that be down to? Is it because the Democrats, as you say, have become a bit smarter in how they deal with him? Is it because the media has become a bit smarter as well? How do you explain it?
It's very hard to explain. I mean, I think, you know, Republicans will say the fundamentals of the race are still in his favor. And I think that's probably true, although getting less true by each day as it's going at the moment. I mean, if you look at Wisconsin, she's ahead. These are the key swing states. Wisconsin, she's ahead. Michigan looks like she might be able to win. Georgia is getting a bit tighter. Pennsylvania is tightening up. But Trump is still in a position to win the election. And if the polls are right and the election was held today, I think Trump would win. But he does not have the momentum, and she does. And conventions always give a bounce in momentum just because they're in the news. It's all very buzzy and exciting. And so we'll see a further bounce, which probably will put her ahead in this race. But I think that Trump is probably thinking, not that I have any real insight into his insane brain, he has to let this momentum, because he understands how the media creates momentum. He has to let this momentum happen, and then there will be an October surprise, or there'll be something that will change the race again in his favour. But it's certainly true that the kind of the Trump juju is not working at the moment.
And I guess underneath the surface of all of that stuff, you know, the kind of the flam and the vibes and the synthetic nature of showy American politics, I guess underneath the surface of it, out in America itself, and you will have had some experience of this, I guess there are still those constituencies who are keen on Trump for many reasons that make sense, you know, working class communities, Rust Belt areas, what we call in Britain the left behind towns and cities who feel betrayed by the old establishment. You know, that was the wave on which Trump made so many inroads in 2016, and then when he won and was inaugurated in 2017. Those people are still there, right?
Yes, and there's new elements to the Trump coalition, or growing elements of the Trump coalition. African-American voters, he's still growing among them in crucial areas. I mean, there was a funny video that came out yesterday of two black women being asked, you know, about Kamala Harris, and they were saying, you think you can just get Megan Thee Stallion, you know, the rap star, to twerk an event and we're going to buy that? But that is so ignorant. And, you know, so I think a lot of African-American voters do feel taken for granted by the Democratic Party. And they like Trump because the system so obviously hates them. And, you know, the elite despise him, and they like the fact that he's so bold. And he's always had appeal among black people. I mean, going back to the 80s days, when, you know, with rap and he was, you know, he was very bling, everything Trump, you know, rappers used to say stuff was Trump as though it was a compliment. So he's always had that appeal. And then among working class voters in all the swing states, yes, he represents the dispossessed. And I mean, I remember back in 2016, you, Brendan, sent me that extraordinary Michael Moore video with the rousing music. Moore was essentially trying to say Trump is awful. It was edited to have all these sort of very moving scenes of poor but noble-looking people at Trump rallies. And it's just an amazing piece of political propaganda that somebody clipped that video together in 2016, because you really feel the rage that those poor people felt, and that Donald Trump spoke to their rage because he stood up to the system that had robbed them of their lives.
Absolutely. Yeah, I remember that video well. I still watch it every now and then to get myself going when I want to political pick me up. Let's talk about JD Vance as well. You know, I find him very interesting. I do worry sometimes that he's very online, and sometimes he says things and I think to myself, I'm not sure people who aren't on X will understand what you're talking about there. So he has that danger, I think, in the way he thinks and campaigns. But what's your general sense of Vance? He's unquestionably an interesting person with an interesting backstory that many people will be familiar with. Has he contributed to the Trump campaign? Is he going to accentuate it, make it more attractive, or could he be a bit of a burden on it?
Even though I thought his appointment was really interesting and possibly a good thing, you have to say that he hasn't had a great time so far since he's become the vice presidential nominee. But I think that Trump was trying to pick a successor. He wasn't trying to win the election by appealing to a particular swing state or demographic. He was trying to appoint someone who would take on his movement. And, you know, egomaniac leaders like Trump tend not to be very good at picking people to replace them. And I think what Vance maybe proves, and it's sad, is that much as though people like you and I like talking about, you know, the political phenomenon of Trumpism and populism and so on, and that there are these huge currents driving American politics, and I'm sure there are. But if you take Trump away from Trumpism, you just have an ism. And can Vance really turn it into an America First coalition? I think there is a strong level of support for that, but I think you need that bizarre, unpredictable appeal that Trump has. Which is not ideological at all. It's very transactional on every issue. Whereas Vance is a much more thoughtful, cerebral person. And unfortunately, I don't think cerebral people suit modern politics.
If you're a regular listener to this show or a regular reader of Spiked, why not become a Spiked supporter? Spiked supporters is our thriving community of people who donate to Spiked. Anyone who gives £5 or more a month or £50 or more a year can become a Spiked supporter and get access to lots of exciting perks. Spiked supporters can comment on articles, get free and discounted tickets to events, get a discount on all items in our shop, and bookmark articles as you browse. This is our way of saying thank you to all of you who fund our work. Spiked is completely free, and yet you still hand over your hard-earned cash to make sure that anyone, anywhere can read us and listen to us. We're incredibly grateful for your generosity. If you don't give to Spiked yet, now is the perfect time to start. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to set up your donation and your Spiked supporters account. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.
You know, that's very well put. And it is the million-dollar question in some ways, isn't it, in relation to the future of Trumpism or the future of populism in America? Because I kind of find myself flitting between thinking that Trump is a mere expression of an underlying anger or populist concern, and also then thinking that actually Trumpism is a thing in and of itself, which is its own form of politics or its own form of anti-politics, however one might want to describe it. Because I think one of the appeals of Trump, surely, which might contradict, you know, the rise of Vance, the kind of more cerebral candidate, you know, one of the appeals of Trump is that he is a blunt instrument. He's a blunt cudgel that I think lots and lots and lots of Americans, you know, fairly wisely thought, and they were right, that they could wield against the establishment. And they wielded it pretty well, and it landed, and it made the impact that many of them wanted to make. Is it possible that populism will run out of steam in America once Trump runs out of steam? Or is there something else there that could gather pace and be expressed in a different way?
Well, I think just focusing on Vance, I think even though he's had a rough time, there's plenty of time for him to turn it around. And he's a little bit awkward, but he is good at debates. And I think there's this assumption now that Waltz, who's this big star at the moment in Democratic circles, is going to just wipe the floor with him. And I think, you know, if Vance has a very successful debate, it's coming up in a few days, that could be really important for him and for the whole movement, because it was sort of established that Trumpism does have a future beyond Trump. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see. And I guess if Trump is elected and Vance is vice president, you know, it's thought that he will be very involved in forming the policies, the America First policies that Trump supporters so want. And that could mean that the legacy will continue. But I do think it's a tough act to follow.
Yeah, absolutely. The toughest act to follow in some ways. You mentioned earlier the Democrats' strategy now of not getting too het up about Trump and appearing unfazed by him, and also denouncing Trump and in particular J.D. Vance as just weird. And I did want to ask you how that's playing out in America more broadly. I mean, the obvious response, and many people have made it, is, you know, how rich it is for people who support, I don't know, the mutilation of young girls or, you know, all sorts of other cranky modern ideologies, how weird it is for them to accuse other people of being weird. And I think that is a legitimate point. J.D. Vance doesn't strike me as particularly weird. I agree with you. He's a bit awkward sometimes. He might be a bit stiff at times, but I don't think his views are that weird. And he doesn't seem to me to be a particularly weird person. But is that landing? Is that working? Is it only working in the kind of media circles, or is it having any impact across the country?
I think it probably is working to a certain extent in that, you know, it's childish, but a lot of people are quite childish in the way they view politics. You know, I'm not excluding myself. I think I probably am too. And it's kind of, you know, calling someone weird, if there's enough people doing it, it's like school bully mentality. You know, eventually you join in with the bullies and you'd say, yeah, he is weird. And it kind of works as a criticism, and it's stupid that it does, but it does. I always think it's like saying, you know, in an argument, if someone's talking and you just go, nah, there's no comeback. And saying, oh, you're weird, there's no comeback to that, really. You can't say, no, I'm not, because you sound weird. Or you can do what they've tried to do, which is, you guys are the weird ones, but then it just becomes a strange exchange of childish insults.
Okay, yeah, no, I get that. It's all very in-between us, I think. It's kind of hard to know where it's going to end up. Okay, Freddie, my last question for you to put you on the spot is, I want to hear your prediction about how you think things will pan out. You kind of indicated that, like the rest of us, you don't know. but if you had to put a bit of money on it, and bearing in mind the potential October surprise, the potential resurgence of the Trump impact, all those things that may well happen over the next few months, do you think there's going to be a second Trump term? I mean, lots of people want it. Some people don't, of course. Or do you think Kamala Harris is going to occupy the White House despite having hardly any credentials that would justify her doing so? How do you think it's going to pan out?
Well, I'll try and not be cowardly and bottle it. But I would like to say before I make my prediction that I have no idea, because I think it's so tight and it's going to be very, very close. And, you know, before Biden pulled out the race, it was looking very, very likely that Trump would win. But I think now it's all to play for. And I think something that happens in the last 2-3 weeks of the campaign will decide the election. I think that is actually often the case. And I think it will be again. But as things stand now, I think you probably say Trump still wins. But I'm going to, at the last minute, change my mind. I'm literally changing my mind as I'm answering. I think I'm going to say Harris actually could win. This is not something I want, but I think, yes, I think Harris might nip it at the end. And it will be one of the most extraordinary political stories. And I think the shortness of the campaign is so striking. We've recently had a short election campaign in the UK. But the fact that it's short has helped her, because it gives her less time to be exposed. I can't believe I've just predicted that Kamala Harris is going to... Can I change my mind again and say it's going to be Trump?
Freddie, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brendan. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.